Okay, Big Daddy Ray's rolling.
Holy shit. What are we doing? 13? Is it 13?
I hope it's 13. Yes.
All right. On 3, 2, 1. Welcome back, ladies, gentlemen, boys and girls, to the podcast. That's it, what it is.
Yeah,
that,
yeah, that's a podcast.
That the iTunes podcast's Twitter account called An Enlightening Look at Julius Caesar with Myth-Busting Anecdotes and Fascinating Parallels. June 26th on the Twitters to their 318,000 followers, which is almost as many women as Ray has slept with in his life.
That's right.
Welcome back. Now, Ray, how are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm good. You've got a snake problem, though. It's not as bad as a crab problem, but you've got a snake
problem. Right. I'm over that now, I'm very happy to say. No, I was stepping out of my door to go to work the other day, and my right foot came within 6 inches of a copperhead, a poisonous snake, very common here in Virginia. And once I saw the snake, I gave a manly, as opposed to what you might have thought. Oh, my God. Anyway, so I stepped away from the snake, and, of course, the wife and daughters heard me, and they come running out, and they tell me I have to kill it. And, of course, the six-year-old who knows everything told me the only way you can kill a snake is to cut its head off. So I grabbed an axe because I live in the middle of nowhere and I have axes all over the place, cut its head off, and then I came home later on that day, and my eight-year-old was not speaking to me. And I finally asked her, I said, why aren't you talking to me? And she started crying and said, you killed that snake, Dad. You killed that snake. I said, honey, but it was a poisonous one, and you don't understand. No, Dad, you told me never to kill. So anyway, I tried to explain it to her over and over, and she just wouldn't stop. So I just finally came back with, shut up. Just shut up and quit crying right now, okay? I saved your life. I saved my life.
Yeah.
And not only that, but I was on a roll at this point. She's lucky I didn't have an accent this time. But the point is, when she was in utero, her mother almost stepped on her copperhead, and I noticed at the last second the snake was there, and so I stopped her mother. So that's twice I have saved this child, maybe not death, but at least some serious illness. And she's worried more about the snake than me. So now just know if you cross me, I'll cut your head off.
You know where you stand.
That's right. That's
you,
right.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah. Am I a hero? You know, that's for others to decide.
Really.
Yeah, or confirm. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, sorry to hear that, man. Of course, you know, whilst you probably think your copperhead snakes are dangerous.
Right.
Australian copperhead snakes laugh at your copperhead snakes.
Yeah, I heard y'all have some of the most poisonous animals in the world between, I guess, bugs and reptiles and things like that.
Yeah. If it can kill you, we've got it.
yeah, you can keep it there.
Well, good luck with the snake problem. I nearly stepped on a snake in our front yard a couple of weeks ago as well. It moved away too fast for me to see what it was, but it was about 2 meters long. And I did scream like a little girl.
Yeah.
Very much.
Yeah. So did I. I was just trying to. That was a revisionist history.
Hold on. I've started Chrissy's metronome. Better stop that. That was a Caesar's commentaries.
Exactly. Ray's commentaries.
Ray's commentaries.
That's right.
By the way, I don't. We're not going to talk about reviews at the beginning of the show, and you can blame it on Jay Leslar from the United States, wrote a review on the iTunes that said, we spend too much time congratulating ourselves on how clever we are by reading reviews on each episode. This practice has gotten old and detracts from my listening pleasure.
Aww.
It has lost a lot of its primary appeal. So,
thanks, Jay.
We'll be sending a coffee mug with a copperhead snake in it to Jay Leslar. Just send us your address, Jay Leslar.
I will do that.
Posted on Facebook, we know where you live. Well, we don't, but the NSA probably does. And
that's
we're
right.
And we know they're big fans of the show, so we're going to...
Getting
back to iTunes, though.
Yeah. Focus.
We should send a thank you coffee mug to Scott. Scott? What did I say? Scott. James James Boggs and the team at iTunes Podcast for that review. That was very nice. I've never seen that before. And as I showed Ray, if you go to iTunes Podcast, twitter.com/iTunes Podcast, and you scroll down to June 26, you'll see us. If you look below that, there's a photo of the Red Rocker, Sammy Hagar himself, and a podcast. Now, I'm a Dave man myself. But, you know, I'll take Sammy. He's second best. We followed. They posted Sammy Hagar podcast and then us. So, and then Keith and the
Not
Girl,
bad.
Who have been around for a long time. You'd never heard of them, but they were big.
No, that's fine. Not bad.
Not bad at all. So, Ray, big episode today, episode 13. Lucky 13.
Yes.
But before we get into Lucky 13, why don't we recap last episode, episode 12, for those people that haven't listened to us for a couple of weeks. I feel sorry for them. By the way, can I just say, people, I know I'm digressing here, but I woke up at 5 o'clock this morning because I had a crying baby in my room and I had to tend to said crying baby. And finally got crying baby to sleep about half an hour later. Decide for some unknown reason to check my emails on my iPhone. See an email from Ray that he sent me at 4 a.m. my time, asking if we can move the recording up an hour from 9 a.m. to 8 a.m. He sends me an email at 4 a.m. my time saying, hey, can we move this to 8 a.m.? Like he knew... Yeah. And lucky for Ray, I do have a Ray signal on my. It's a bit like the bat signal,
right?
But it's the Ray signal.
I like it
because whenever I get an email from Ray, I get this thing blast, and it's Ray 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 Harris Ray 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 Ray.
I like that. So I thought you were going to say you had radar.
So yeah, radar. Very good. So very early in the morning, my time, and If at any stage Ray asks a question and I don't answer, it's probably because I've fallen back asleep.
Right. Can I rebut? I have a rebuttal.
Sure. Go.
Thank you. Your Honor.
The chair calls the esteemed congressman from Virginia.
Your Honor, I have recorded the U.S. versus Germany match. I have ignored all news and internet today. I have no idea who won. And as soon as we finish recording, I'm going to plop down right in front of the TV and put it on. And with the axe in my hand, dare any family members to bother me. So I've been looking forward to this. I'm totally into the world. I've never watched football, European or whatever version before, but I'm totally into this, having a good time, and I just want to know who wins. And so that it was the reason for my request.
And that was the other interesting thing is you sent me this email saying, don't tell me who won between the US and Germany, like I would know or give a shit.
Is that because Australia's out? Sorry, I'm just saying.
No, it's because... you know, my IQ is above 90, so I don't follow sport.
Oh, gotcha.
Boom.
Wow, he is condescending. Anyway, so, no, but this is new for me. I've never followed soccer, but I, you know, you get into it. So I'm looking forward to it.
Good stuff. I have been watching some highlights with my kids because they play soccer on the YouTubes. Pretty good stuff. All right.
Yes.
Episode 12, yes. Ray. Let's
focus.
Stop mucking around.
So here's what we know. So far, it was early March of 58 BCE, and Julius Caesar is hanging on the edge of Rome. He needs to get to his province, but he needs to make sure that all that work he had done the previous year as consul is going to stick. So he's staying, he's hanging around, making sure no one does anything, no one tries to invalidate his entire year's worth of work. But he's getting word from his agents, and he has, and a very smart general always has agents, spies, informants, whatever you want to call it, out and about. And it seems that the Helvetii, a Gaul tribe, they call themselves Celts, are trying to go to Western Gaul, and they need to cross over the top of Transalpine Gaul, the northern section. And of course, he can't allow that. And let's all be blunt, he is looking for reasons to have wars of aggression so he can make a name for himself and make some money. So he finally has to dash away from Rome to get to the Rhone River, I believe it is, where they're at. So he leaves the very edge of Rome, and something that's typical for Caesar that will amaze his enemies, not only for the next 9 years in Gaul, but also during the Civil War. This man is able to move at incredible speeds. He's very disciplined, requires very little sleep, it seems, and averaging about 90 miles a day, he is able to go to the edge of Rome, to the Rhone River, to be in front of the Helvetii in about 9 days. And now he's got to make plans because he is totally unprepared for the mass of people that are trying to go through his province.
That's right. Now, question, Ray.
Yes.
What is the connection between Caesar's first campaign against the Gauls and IOS 7?
That is a really deep, profound question. And yeah, I could give you an answer, but why don't you give me your answer and I'll let you know if you got it right. I don't know.
Well, the standard font on IOS 7 is Nue Helvetica.
Ah.
Which every time I read about this thing, the Helvetii, I think Helvetica.
Yeah.
Now, of course, do you know what Helvetica means in Latin?
Absolutely not.
That's right. That's what it means. Absolutely not. Yeah. It means the Swiss or Swiss. And so the Helvetii were sort of occupying the area that they were in when they decided, you know what, screw this place, we're going somewhere else, was kind of Switzerland. So, you know. Who could blame them for not wanting to live in Switzerland?
Yeah,
it's you know,
and the other reason for that, the eastern edge of what we're going to loosely call Gaul is the Rhine River, and on the other side of the Rhine River are a whole bunch of German tribes that I'm sure are giving the Helvetii a hard time. And what Caesar doesn't know at first, it's going to take him a while to find this out. The Helvetii really want to travel to Western Gaul to settle down, and quite honestly, the plundering there should be easier compared to trying to plunder German tribes. And so this is something they're not telling anybody, but that's one of the motivating factors as well, is to get away from the tough Germans.
So we're 58 BCE, early in the year, 28th of March, apparently, is when they began to gather on the River Rhone, the Helvetii. Yes, I am going to say that for the rest of the episode. Near Lake Geneva. Now, according to Caesar, there was about 368,000 people. And he said that in his commentaries I was reading last night, he said he knew that because he was able to see their census. They had some records Greek numbers tallying up all of the different tribes and all of the people in all the different tribes. 368,000 people. Now, that was men, women, and children. Mm-hmm. But apparently historians dispute that somewhat. They think it could have been a lot less than that, but it's hard to say. All we really have is, you know, well, A, what Caesar told us, and Caesar may have had reason to sort of buffer up the numbers to make himself look good. Or maybe the Helvetii were bad at math when they were compiling their own records. We don't know. But it was a lot. But 400,000 people is a lot of people, 368,000. Now, the other story that's fascinating here is, from my perspective, is they decide to move, as you say. They want to go to better land. They didn't like where they were. They were hemmed in. There was mountains. There was Germans. It was cold. Everyone was running around with cuckoo clocks and Swiss Army knives. They were trying to figure out what to do with the little fork thing on the Swiss Army knife for decades. They couldn't work it. They were, screw this, we're getting out of here.
That's right.
But this was a big thing. Like, you don't move 400,000 people overnight. So they'd been planning it for 2 years. But apparently there was sort of a cunning scheme behind this. Like, what the Helvetii didn't have kings. Like the Romans, they had abandoned the idea of kings, and they were governed by sort of a combination of sort of elections and chieftains, like tribal leaders, not kings, but, you know, sort of tribal chiefs that would get together and would talk and discuss, which, I don't know, I always thought the Gauls were probably, you know, you always see them depicted as, you know, heathens.
Right.
But that sounds quite, you know, advanced and civilized. Did that surprise you?
Yeah, and the other thing, and it's just so hard to pin down, and because of communication is really hard within the entirety of Gaul, it pretty much comes down to a few strong men. You can have a smaller tribe with maybe one leader, or like you were saying, if it's a much larger group of people, you probably have what we could loosely call barons or tribal chiefs or whatever, almost like a council of people, and so no one person could stand out. So that's certainly unexpected, because Caesar's going to do what he needs to do to make these people look barbaric and dangerous and very un-Roman. But they obviously, when it comes to politics, had worked some stuff out as far as not having the power all in one person, yeah. You know, compass into one person.
I mean, we sort of celebrate the Roman Republic for disposing of the monarchy and experimenting with democracy, but it wasn't just the Romans. I think that's a really important point to understand. The other interesting thing that Caesar tells us, or one of the other interesting things, is that before the Helvetii left, you know, Helvetica.
Mm-hmm. Sure, why not?
Their homeland. They torched all the villages, all the houses, right. the crops. They torched the whole thing because this was going to be a long and arduous journey and they didn't want anyone to go, screw this, I'm going home.
I'm going back.
So they burnt the thing. They scorched earth policy. They torched the whole thing. And that's commitment, man. That is,
yeah.
That's a bit like, who burnt the boats? Was it
Cortez?
Cortez, yeah.
Yes. He's like, this is how serious we either will succeed or die trying. So, yeah. But I thought it was interesting that Orgetorix, the nominal leader of the Helvetii, is not only very motivated and a leader, but he's also a pretty good tactician, and he's able to contact one of the leaders of the Edui and the Sequani, and he's saying, look, we're coming through your territory, we just want to settle down, but here's what I'm willing to do for you. And when earlier, when you were giving the numbers of the tribes, let's say we're totally wrong, we don't know how many people there were, but you've got to think that the Helvetii have at least, what, 40 to 80,000 warriors. You know, I mean, that's just a lot of military power right there. And it could have been as high as 100,000. We don't know, but he's obviously got a very large army. And he says to the two leaders, and he says, you let me come through your land. And if you ever want to try to be king of your respective group of people or tribe or whatever, I'll help you with my warriors to become king. So he's using diplomacy as well. And humans being what they are, those two gentlemen say, yes, that's a very good idea. So he's not going to have any trouble with the Edui. He's not going to have any trouble with the Sequani, but there's Caesar that he has to deal with.
That's your end of the episode voice. Are we finished already?
No, sorry. Sorry. And we're done.
So they formed a triumvirate. We had a
Gaulish
Roman
triumvirate.
We had the Gaulish triumvirate. Getting back to the burning of the villages thing, one point I was going to make before you moved on was that historians, again, doubt the accuracy of this story. They have been searching through this whole area of where the Helvetii supposedly lived. And there are signs, apparently, archaeological signs of, you know, a village here or a village there burnt down that might be dated to this period, 58 BCE. But there are no signs that they've been able to find so far of, you know, a series of villages that could have contained 368,000 people having been completely torched all at the same time. So, again, you know, we just have to remind ourselves when reading through this that this was written by Caesar based on stories he'd heard. And, you know, there might be some embellishment from him. There might be some embellishment from the people telling him the stories. We can't treat these stories as factual. We can enjoy them for what they are.
Right.
But, you know, we have to take all of it with a grain of salt.
Yeah, and sadly, it's probably in some ways as close as we're going to come to the truth is by whatever Caesar has written down, because almost everything else has not survived, and we're just kind of piecing it together as best we can.
Archaeological records are obviously difficult to find, and shit doesn't get preserved, but we can use archaeology to try and sanity check some of the stuff that Caesar says, like you would expect to be able to find, I think, evidence of, a whole series of villages being burnt down. But yeah, this is all we've got, which is so tragic, isn't it? Like, it's just such a tragedy that you must have think about all of the books that were written, and we don't want to get into the Library of Alexandria, etc. But it's just absolutely breaks my heart when I think about the knowledge and the writings from this period that have been lost to time.
Right, it's a staggering loss for humanity, and just to really have a sense of what was known, what we could know, and just to make the experience of reading this history that much more pleasurable and deeper.
For the rest of the episode, by the way, do you mind if we refer to Orgetorix as Orgetorix? Because I was reading it as Orgetorix last night.
I'm sure you were,
and it just made the whole thing a lot more amusing. I like to amuse myself.
So we've got Murray telling us to pronounce it correctly, and I've got another Aussie telling me to pronounce it on purpose incorrectly. Okay, this is no problem. I'm going to be able to do this. Look, so here's what. Go ahead.
I just go for the laughs, man. That's all I'm doing.
Here's what I thought was interesting. So, like you said, they planned for 2 years, because you can't just move 300 and something thousand people. They had to plan for 2 years. They gathered all the animals they could, and quite frankly, stole some more. They planted crops for 2 years to gather those up. They're all ready to go. Orgetorix makes his plans with the Edui and the Sequani. He's got everything laid out, but then some of the other powerful people of the Helvetii find out about the deals he's made with the Sequani and the Edui, and they put him on trial, and there's a whole we don't have to go into it, but there's this whole thing that happens, and he ends up dead.
Don't shortcut it. It's a good story.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry. I'll let you tell.
By the way, Caesar ends up dead too. Thank you very much. We're out.
Good night, folks. Okay, well, I'll let you tell it, because I'm trying to remember the details.
By the way,
but I just thought it was
just for
amazing.
The record, Ray, everybody ends up dead.
That's true. Now I'm sad. The snake certainly did. But even though he dies, and I'm sorry that I ruined it for everybody, the plan, you don't just stop a plan that's 2 years in the making. These people are going west no matter what it takes. But I'm sorry, go ahead. You can tell the story.
Oh, my God. So, Orgetorix, or Orgetorix. as you said, the other leaders found out that he was, planning a coup d'etat, basically. He and Casticus of the Sequani and the unfortunately named Dumnorix.
I love that.
Orgy and Dumnorix were planning on, taking power. And again, I wonder if they'd heard what had happened in Rome with the triumvirate. Had they heard about Caesar and Cassius and Pompey, who they always pronounced as Pompey, and people used to yell at them.
Absolutely.
And they were like, well, it works in Rome, it can work here. I wonder how much they were borrowing the idea. Anyway, so they found out about it, and they were going to put him on trial. Now, the penalty for the crime of trying to turn yourself into a king in the in the Helvetica tribes, the Helvetii, was to be burned alive. That was the penalty.
Damn.
So, Orgetorix, he doesn't take this lightly. He rocks up. They say, okay, your trial's going to be on, Monday. There was a day appointed. Right. And he rocks up with like 10,000 warriors to the trial. Again, he's calling on the memory of Marius and Sulla and foreshadowing Caesar. These same sorts of plays play out, whether it's in Rome or it's in Gaul. So he rocks up going, sure, put me on trial, no problems. By the way, here's my army.
My entourage.
Yeah, my entourage. 10,000 men, which historians estimate was probably an eighth or a tenth of the entire military strength of the Helvetii. So the rest of the tribal leaders go, okay, fine, not a problem. Look at the time. I think I left the oven on.
That's right.
And we won't have a trial today. Sorry, everybody. No trial today.
Bad omens.
Hey, that's what I said to you in the email about the snakes, right? It's an omen that you're going to be made emperor of Virginia.
Nice. Thank you.
Although I think you already were, but anyway, maybe this means you're going to get assassinated. I don't know.
Ah, crap.
So then they take a break from the trial. Then the rest of the Helvetii leaders pull together their own military force and arrest him again, and he's awaiting trial again. No. They pull together an army. They go to arrest him. They don't arrest him. There's a civil war going to break out, and then he's found dead, or Orgy Drix. Rumors of suicide.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a bit like the old Catiline suicide.
Right.
You know.
It's a little too convenient.
Yeah. So, again, reading through this, these stories play out again and again, whether it's Rome or the Gauls. Power plays, psychopaths, greed, fake suicides, rocking up with an army, entourage, you know.
Yep.
Anyway, so as you said, cutting to the he's dead.
He's dead. But you don't stop a plan 2 years in the making. So Caesar shows up. He's only got one legion with him right now, and there's officially a crapload of people on the other side of the river.
And remind everyone how many people in a legion?
Oh, is that 4,000? I'm trying to remember now.
Between 3,000 to 6,000,
3,000 to 6,000. So okay, Caesar
Caesar's got 3,000 to 6,000 men. They've got 350,000 people.
Yeah.
So women and children there. They reckon about a quarter of that, 90,000 to 100,000, something like that, were probably men, warriors.
Right.
So 100,000 versus Caesar's 4,000, 5,000, 6,000.
Yeah. So Caesar's not quite ready to go to war with them. So the Helvetii. So Caesar has his one legion tear down the bridge that's crossing the river, and he sends out word to his allies nearby to start levying troops. And so the Helvetii send emissaries to him, and they say, "Look, we want to cross. We just want to go. No trouble. We won't plunder. We're not going to do anything. We just want to go across, settle down somewhere, and get away from the Germans and the harsh conditions." And Caesar says, "Yeah, I don't know. I got to think about it. Why don't you come back on the Ides of April, April 13th, and I will let you know my feelings then." And then I really enjoy this part. Then in the commentaries, Caesar stops right there and he reminds his audience. He literally stops the story and he reminds the audience. He goes, "You know, back in 107 BCE, the Helvetii were one of many tribes that annihilated Roman armies. There was the Cimbri, the Teutones, some other ones. But the Helvetii made the troops who survived the massacre walk under the yoke, thus turning them from soldiers to citizens. So it was a huge embarrassment for Rome at the time." And basically what he's saying is that happened in 107. It's not going to happen on my watch. Never again. And he's like giving his oath. So he's almost like working up his audience as they're reading the story to let them know why he's going to do what he's about to do.
And again, we have to take everything, or Caesar's positioning of this, with a grain of salt.
Right.
I mean, yes, they obviously did have a track record. They jumped the Romans, apparently, when Cassius the Elder was in charge of the troops there. They sort of took them by surprise. They hadn't declared war and sort of routed the Roman troops at the time. So he had a reason not to trust them. But his whole justification for going to war with them in this is possibly dubious. He's suggesting that, we don't want them anywhere in this part of the world. We want them to go back to where we like things the way they are. He was a conservative. We don't want change. We like you where you are.
We're good.
Yeah. So he says, as you said, go away and think. Go away. Give me some time. Come back in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
and I'll have made a decision as to whether or not you can come and settle on the land. And they so they go, oh, all right, well, Caesar's a reasonable guy. They go away. They come back. And in the meantime, he has built the mother of all walls in 2 weeks. Like,
that's right.
Engineering magic. He has built a wall, like made out of dirt, basically, but
still
mud, dirt. It was 19 Roman miles long, so that's about 1.48 kilometers in civilized terms, or in American terms.
Ouch! Just a little less than one of our miles.
19 miles.
Yeah.
No.
I mean, I'm sorry. 1 mile is one Roman 1. Mile 6, is slightly probably. Small. Yeah. So, so, but still, I
and
mean,
it was
it's 19
16 feet high.
That's just amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Which in metric is 2.5 feet to a meter, eight meters, a bit less than meters.
Yeah, carry the two. Yeah, so it's an impressive engineering marvel that just gives the Helvetii and the Gauls and the Germans of the future a taste of what his men are capable, or what Romans are capable of.
Building walls.
Yes.
Yeah.
For military reasons.
The Helvetii are like, well. So what do they do? They've got 350,000 people. They've burnt their villages, possibly. They've been traveling for God knows how long to get there. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, Caesar goes,
No, that, I don't think so.
Ye shall not pass. So put yourself in the Helvetii shoes for a second. What are they going to do? I mean, they can't. I mean, I guess they could turn around and go back and go, all right, well.
Let's build.
start again. So they go, we'll just go up a bit. The wall's only 1.48 kilometers long, 19 Roman miles. We'll just go up the river and cross there. No biggie, right?
Right, right.
So they go up and they start crossing. Oh, no, first they have a bit of a skirmish, don't they, at the wall?
Yeah. Right, there's no major assaults across the wall, but some of them try to load up, tie up rafts and try to cross and do the best they can at night, that kind of stuff. But there's no – and this surprised me. There's no major engagement. It's not like they said, well, we've got all these men. All you've got is this wall. But instead, they're going to try and go around. But then I realized, because of the deal that they had with the Sequani and the Aedui, that when they do go north over the wall – above the wall, they're not going to have any trouble with the Gauls there because they've already got that deal in place. And so they just literally skirt around the wall and just start going in. And Caesar's like, okay, I got to come up with plan B.
Yeah. So they go up the river a bit and they decide they're going to pass through the Jura Mountains. They're going to try and get to the lands of the Aedui and the Sequani. Obviously, Caesar finds out about this, he's like, "Ah, damn these people!" So he leaves Labienus, Labienus that we talked about. So I don't know how you pronounce it, Labienus.
Titus Labienus. And don't put the emphasis on the anus. Just Titus Labienus.
He was who we mentioned last time as one of the very few. Respectable guys that wanted to go with Caesar on this campaign. He puts him in charge of what's going on here. So I'm just pouring more coffee. Can you hear that?
So he puts Titus in charge of his one legion, and Caesar books it east to is that Aquileia? I'm not sure if I'm saying it right. Aquileia, which is in northern Italy on the far eastern side. He travels a very long distance. And what does he do? And I don't want to take your thunder while you're pouring and probably sipping your coffee, but he raises two more legions. He raises the 11th and the 12th legions. Now, obviously, it takes a lot to raise a legion, to train them, to equip them. He knew he was going to need them, and so he had given the word earlier, but he's there to collect them now, no matter what the state that they're in. But now, the Caesar...
Sorry. No.
Okay. Now, Caesar doesn't have the authority. No, you had your chance. Caesar doesn't have the authority to raise any more legions. So what's his attitude? And the Senate's not going to pay for it because they're the ones who get permission. What's Caesar's attitude? Now, what was really interesting was most of these men come from the Cisalpine Gaul. Technically, they can't be legionaries because they're not Roman citizens. So he's breaking rules left and right. What's his attitude?
I am Caesar.
Hear me roar. So he's got his two new legions, and he's going to fly back as fast as he can in typical Caesar fashion, all the way back. And by the time he gets back there in front of the Helvetii, now he has his six legions. He had his legions before. Now he's got the two more. But I still think it's interesting. This is what I love about the Romans. Even with all these men, he's got about 25 to 30,000 men. He's got some cavalry. He's got some light infantry. But that's still nothing compared to the 80, 90, 100,000, whatever, warriors the Helvetii have. I mean, in any other situation, this would be still not be a contest. But the Romans are so organized and disciplined, and they care about their troops and information and communication and organization that is going to make the difference, even though they're outnumbered by incredible odds.
Yeah, but not only outnumbered. So they've got maybe 20 to 25,000 troops Caesar has now, mm-hmm. versus, as you say, 350,000, about 90 to 100,000 of those are probably men, right. soldiers. But, you know, the two new legions that he just pulled together aren't Roman. They're not legionnaires. They're not trained. They're not Romans.
Right.
So, you know, even half of that force that he's got are brand new, green, wet behind the ear amateurs that,
sure.
you know, he and his men are going to have to get into shape to be able to fight the Roman way. So it's, you know, it's an amazing feat of boldness that he even thought this was doable. Massively outnumbered and with a bunch of newbies, but... You know, he's Caesar.
Yeah.
He's like, it'll do.
Yeah, I can do this.
So he goes after the Helvetii. You know, they have to go through the Alps, which is the quickest way to catch up to them. You know, it's surrounded by Roman provinces, but the Alps itself is unconquered. So there's like tribes through there that are attacking them as they go, but you know the Romans are able to beat those off,
right?
And so he catches up to the troops that he had left in the Allobroge territory. So he's now mm-hmm. he had five legions with him. He catches up with those guys. Now he's got six legions, something like 25 to 30,000 guys, plus a cavalry of maybe 4,000 men, some light infantry, plus. He's got slaves that have to, you know, carry the bags,
support staff and stuff like that. Yeah,
all of that kind of stuff. So one of the big issues now is how does he feed all of these people on campaign? Hasn't been preparing for this for, you know, 6 months like you would a normal military campaign. You know, you're able to prepare. You know, he had to hot foot it out of Rome because the Helvetii were on the march. Hasn't been able to prepare for supply train. So he, you know, sends a message to the Aedui, who are supposedly Rome's allies.
Mm-hmm.
Allies.
Allies, mm-hmm.
Aedui, Ali, to get some food. He says, hey,
right.
you're Roman allies.
Yeah.
You need to supply us with food. You know, send us some grain so I can disperse it to the troops.
Right. And for those of you who have read the commentaries or maybe going back and reading the commentaries, I think like every 10th word in the commentaries has something to do with food. I mean, Caesar knows how important this is, and he's always gathering food, making sure there's food. So when he says to the Aedui, get me some food, that's going to become a very – that request is going to have very serious repercussions very soon. But if I could just go off on my own tangent for a second, I think this is my first time. I'm pretty excited.
Oh.
This is the first week.
I'll come up with some theme music for this. I'll put it in.
use the Raise, Game of Thrones.
Raise.
My son is in his first week of recruit training for the Marines in Paris Island. So I just thought it was amazing that Caesar gathers these two legions, and how does he get them ready, he takes them through the fucking Alps, and they're attacked constantly by tribes who don't want them there. That's how you train men. You run up a mountain and you make them fight for their life for, like, you know, hundreds of miles. The Marines should probably try that. But anyway, just reminded me of that since I've been thinking about my son lately. And there's my tangent.
Wow. Yeah. You didn't manage to talk him out of that then, huh? You didn't take my advice and just handcuff him to, you know, the building?
Well, when they showed up, they said, look, we're going to take one of you. And I said, off you go, son. So, yeah.
I'm just glad you didn't send the hot eldest daughter, man.
No, that would have not worked out well. So anyway, I thought it was interesting. So Caesar flies back there, and the Helvetii have reached, I don't know how to say it, the Saone River. I'm not sure. S-A-O-N-E.
I believe the French pronunciation is the Saone.
Saone. Okay. The Saone River. And most of the Helvetii have already crossed the river. They've been at it for like 20 days while Caesar was running through the Alps. They've been at it for 20 days. And roughly the only people still on the far side of the river, I guess on the Romans, where Caesar's coming up on there, is mostly the Tigurini, a tribe of Tigurini. And there's about 1/4 of the Helvetii, and that's them. And they haven't crossed yet when Caesar catches up. Now he's got to decide what he's going to do. They already have broken they've already gone around his wall. And they keep traveling west. He doesn't want them to. He's got the men to do something about it now. So now he has to decide, does he negotiate? Does he attack? Does he try to do something clever? What does he do? I don't know if you want to take it from here, Cam, but he basically waits until the next day, does a surprise dawn attack, and just massacres everyone that they can find on their side of the river. Just literally goes and takes everything and just kills everybody that they can possibly get their hands on. So yeah. Caesar is setting the tone for this from the very beginning.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess Caesar's already given them a warning. He said, no, thou mm-hmm. shalt not pass. He built his wall. Right. And now he's kind of lost patience with them. So, yeah, he just you know, drops on them from out of the sky like a drop bear. And literally wipes them out. It's a complete massacre. Then after they've, you know, cleaned up the stragglers. Right. And by the way, we have to remind people that the stragglers that were still yet to cross the river were the Tigurini had been primarily responsible for the defeat of the Romans in 107 BCE, and where Caesar's grandfather of his father-in-law, Calpurnius yes. Piso, had died in the battle, as Caesar goes to pains in the commentaries to point out.
Right. So this is personal.
Yeah, it was kind of like W going into Iraq. You tried to kill my daddy. that's just to piss off all of the any Republicans still left listening that's right. to the show. So, yeah, it was personal. He goes in and just wipes them out. Then the Romans need to cross the Saone, and they manage it in a single day. They're 25,000 to 30,000 troops. Boom. Romans know how to get shit done. Cross a river, no problem. Bam, we're over.
Well, but that's amazing. I mean, was the last time you picked up a sword and a shield and fought all day long? You get pretty tired. The very next day, they literally build a bridge and cross a river all in one day with 25 to 30,000 men. That is Roman efficiency, and that is just, even to this day, absolutely amazing.
And remember, you know, we said, I think, last episode that they didn't have a dedicated engineer corps like you would have today had in Napoleon's time even. You know, so it was just, anyone know how to build a bridge? Anyone know how to build a boat?
Put your sword away.
Right, go build
Good
a...
on you.
How many boats do you need to move 30,000 guys in a day? Like,
yeah,
300, absolutely amazing. 400? I don't know, man. Yeah. But yeah, so there was no dedicated skills. It was just anyone who knew how to do something dived in and got it done. And they still managed to, you know, get 30,000 people across in a day. It is amazing. But again, you know, this is Caesar's telling of the story.
Right,
so
right.
We can't
Might
take
have taken
it.
A day and a half, yeah. Sorry.
We can't take it as literal, but, you know.
Right.
It's, I mean, again, but to balance this, you know, nobody in Rome, when these were published, that we have records of anyway, and, you know, we have a lot of Cicero's letters, and Cicero was obviously a critic of Caesar. You know, we don't have anyone calling bullshit on this story or any of the stories in this, really, from the day. So it's at least possible that this was achievable. I mean, you would expect that if this was like completely outlandish, at least Cicero would have called bullshit on it.
Right.
So they cross over, and now there's an interesting thing here that historians have called bullshit on. Caesar claims that as he was getting close to the rest of the Helvetii, they sent another delegation to sue for peace. Now, right. Caesar claims that it was headed by a man called Divico, who was the leader of the war back in 107 BCE. Now, yeah. 107 BCE, he was, you know, the war leader, so you imagine he'd have to be, like, at least at the youngest, early 20s, mid-20s.
Right.
This is 58 BCE, so I'll let you do the math on that, because it's too early in the morning for me. 50 years later?
Yeah, that's pushing it. Yeah, it's pushing
50 years later. So he's going to be at the youngest in his early 70s, quite possibly if he was a war leader, you know, he's going to be in his 80s, his 90s at this stage.
Right.
We're supposed to believe, according to Caesar, that this guy was sent as the you know, part of the delegation to sue for peace, and also that he's made the journey so far, marched, you know, 100.
Yeah.
I will walk 100 miles, and I will walk 100.
Because I mean, they're not gonna carry him around if he can't get around on his own.
Nah.
You know, so yeah, so, yeah. Bullshit.
Yeah, people are calling bullshit on that. I mean, it's possible.
Yeah,
but
it's possible.
Highly unlikely.
Maybe anyway, he was a leader at 12. Who knows?
Yeah, he could have been. Could have been like Tutankhamun.
Cool.
So they, you know, they go and they say, "Come on, Caesar, get off our backs, man. We just want to go and settle. We want to live a nice, quiet life. You know, we're not going to cause any trouble. We promise. However, we did kick your asses." They, according to Caesar, they said, "Look, you know, we did kick your Roman's ass,
right.
You know, 50 years ago. So we're not saying we're going to do it again, but, you know."
But, well, I love the part where they go, you know, when you wiped out the Tigurini back there, yeah, it didn't impress us. We could have done it. But I love the way they started out. They say, "Look, you tell us where to settle. We'll go wherever, because that's what we're trying to do. You tell us where to settle. But then just remember, we're not impressed. We don't think you're all that bad. So you better tell us where to settle." And I love it with Caesar's responses. I don't know what the Latin for this is, but it was basically, "Look, don't get uppity. Okay. You're barbarians. We're not. Tell you what, you give me hostages, you pay for all the damages," because there had been some plundering and some raiding by the Helvetii, because you really can't control 400,000 people. You can't just send out word and everybody obeys. So he goes, "You give me hostages, you pay for all the damages you've caused. And you know what? I'll think about it. I'll think about it."
Can I actually read what he wrote in the commentaries? I have it in front of me.
Yes, please.
Thank you all.
Yeah.
Again, I always love it because he's talking in the third person here. It's great. "To these words, Caesar thus replied, that on that very account he felt less hesitation, because he kept in remembrance those circumstances which the Helvetian ambassadors had mentioned, and that he felt the more indignant at them, in proportion as they had happened undeservedly to the Roman people. For if..." This is because they said, you know, "Don't forget, we kicked Rome's ass once upon a time."
Right.
"You know.
Right.
For if they had been conscious of having done any wrong, it would not have been difficult to be on their guard. But for that very reason, they had been deceived, because neither were they aware that any offence had been given by them, on account of which they should be afraid, nor did they think that they ought to be afraid without cause. But even if he were willing to forget their former outrage, could he also lay aside the remembrance of the late wrongs, in that they had against his will attempted a rout through the province by force, in that they had molested the Adui, the Ambari, and the Allobroge?" We forgot to mention too that as the Helvetii are marching through these parts of Gaul, the other tribes are sending you know, people to Caesar complaining that the Helvetii are sort of, you know, foraging, you know, raping, pillaging, acts of violence through their lands. They're coming to Caesar, according to Caesar, and saying, "Come on, dude, like, help us out. These people are a pain in the butt." Caesar continues, that as to their so insolently boasting of their victory, and as to their being astonished that they had so long committed their outrages with impunity, both mm-hmm. these things tended to the same point, and here's the clincher. For the immortal gods are wont to allow those persons whom they wish to punish for their guilt sometimes a greater prosperity and longer impunity in order that they may suffer the more severely from a reverse of circumstances.
Boom, come down with a hammer.
Although these things are so, yet, if hostages were to be given him by them in order that he may be assured that they will do what they promise, and provided they will give satisfaction to the Aedui for the outrages which they had committed against them and their allies, and likewise to the Allobroges, Caesar will make peace with them.
Oh.
Divico, 150 years old, replied that the Helvetii had been so trained by their ancestors that they were accustomed to receive, not to give, hostages. Of that fact, the Roman people were witness. Having given this reply, he withdrew.
Yeah.
Divico,
damn.
Out, y'all. Threw the microphone on the ground, flipped a hand up.
Said, sod off, mate. Yeah, that's right.
Suck it, Caesar. So,
your mama.
Now, we have to remember, like, Caesar, you know, quoting what the immortal gods are wont to do.
Right.
Of course, at this stage, Caesar was still Pontificus Maximus, I think.
That's right.
So, you know, he was the Pope. If anyone knew what the gods had in store, it was probably the Pope.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, I love the way he wrote that, you know. The immortal gods.
That's right. I just thought it was...
It sounds like it's from 300 or something, you know.
Well, I like what the Helvetii say, look, we don't give hostages, okay? Boom, your mama, okay?
We're so givers, we're not takers.
That's right.
We're on top, we're not on bottom.
That's right, that's very important. Anyway, so the Helvetii, they move on, and Caesar's like, shit, okay.
Can I just ask a question? Like, what happened to the Swiss?
Yeah.
I mean, the Swiss were completely badasses back in the day, man. Like, these days... Well, this is what happened to them, I guess.
Yeah,
The Swiss went, all right, that's enough. We're not fighting anymore. We got...
focused on chocolate and clocks, I guess. I really don't know much about the Swiss. I don't mean anything derogatory.
Tools, knives, man.
Tools.
Yeah.
Well, you can focus on a screwdriver or a hammer. You can focus on a sword, and you'll see what the results are. But anyway, so the Helvetii move on, and Caesar's got his men who's following them along. And in between the Helvetii and his legionaries, his infantry, he's got about 4,000 cavalry, and they're in between. And those cavalry are being led by Demorix. How do we say that? Demorix of the Aedui.
Yeah.
Demorix, and he gets ambushed by the Helvetii, and they pretty much bloody his nose and his men's nose. So the Helvetii are emboldened. So Caesar, of course, becomes more cautious, but he's getting further and further away from his what little supplies of food he has. He's getting further and further away from the river, where they can send down supplies. So he's got to. Something has to happen soon because he can't just keep following them and having not the desired outcome.
Now, one of the things that we forgot to mention, I think, earlier is that Dumnorix was married to the daughter of Orgetorix.
Right.
Or Getorix, Orgy man.
Right.
So the dummy was married to the daughter of the Orgy guy. as a, because they were going to do the Triumvirate thing and Orgy got killed, but... You know, Dumnorix is still married. Now, Caesar doesn't know this, see?
That's right.
Caesar doesn't. So he's trusting Dumnorix to lead the cavalry, but he doesn't know that he's actually married to the daughter of the Orgy.
And he's counting on the Aedui to bring him grain. So he's got one guy betraying him in the front that he doesn't know, and he's got one guy betraying him in the back that he doesn't know. So Caesar's in a pickle. He just doesn't know it.
Well, it's the same guy. Betraying him on both sides.
Oh, I was thinking of what's the guy's name? Starts with the. Okay, I'm sorry. I apologize. So the Aedui are literally the longest Roman allies. Let me correct myself. The Aedui, the longest allies of Rome. are the ones, the very ones portraying him, but he doesn't know that he's in this situation, but he's about to find out.
Yeah, so he's like, where is this grain? You guys are supposed to be bringing me the grain. I'm not getting the grain. Yeah. My guys are hungry. I need the grain. Where's the grain?
The damn grain.
Sorry. So he summons the leading men of the Edgeway, Divic...
Divisiacus? Who knows?
Divisiacus, okay, who's a druid. It's kind of awesome. And Liscus. Who was held the post of Vergebrae or Vergebret? He was like the prime minister, the president of the Edgeway at the time, Vergebret, the supreme magistrate of the tribe, which they got elected every year. So again, you know, quite civilized. You don't think of druids and annual elections,
not together.
Same people, right? But this is this is interesting stuff, right?
But I thought it was better that once they served, no one in their family could be Vergebret after that. So you can't have Clinton and Clinton and Bush. Again, that's just very progressive, I thought. And I'm just like...
The Edgeway had it figured out 2,100 years ago. America's still trying to figure that out.
That's right. So,
they knew that was a bad idea 2,100 years ago, but America,
they would consolidate power. Yeah.
So he gets in Divisiacus. Yeah. And Liscus, and he says, what is going on with the goddamn grain? this is not acceptable. And they're like, well, look, there's a guy, don't want to say too much, they start speaking in pidgin English. There's a guy who's big up in the tribe, and he's preventing the grain from leaving.
That's all I can say.
Yeah, I don't want to say too much.
Can't say no more.
So Caesar says, Liscus, like, Liscus, get out of here. And he keeps the druid in there, Divisiacus.
Yep.
You're going to spend the whole episode trying to work it out.
Just edit out the first three times and say Divisiacus.
He keeps Divi in. He says, Divi, come on, dude. Come on. Dude. You're a druid. That's right. You know?
You're a Vulcan. You can't lie.
Tell me what's going on, Drew.
Right.
Divi the Drew. And Divi the Drew says, look, Julie. Dumnorix is my brother.
That's right.
And he's my little brother, and he's dumb. That's why we call him Dumnorix.
That's right.
And Dumnorix is the guy that's stopping you getting the grain. Mm-hmm. And he's married to the daughter of Orgy, and he wants to be king. And in fact, historians have found coins from this period with the name Dumnorix on it, which they think is probably, he was printing his own coins already.
That's
going,
a giveaway.
Dude, I'm going to be king, yeah. Which Orgetorix did that as well, by the way, had his own coins, which we have, coins. They did their triumvirate deal, and before the ink was dry, they were printing their own coins with their faces on them as kings.
That's confident.
Yeah.
That's confident.
That's bold, right?
That's right.
So Divi rats out Dumnorix to Caesar, but then he begs for his brother's life. He's like, dude,
please,
he's my brother, and he's pissy at me already because Vergebret. And now Vergebret. I was Vergebret before I was a druid. I was Vergebret. Now he can't be Vergebret. So he's already cranky at me. Actually, and I want to read this section out of the commentaries at length because it's kind of good. Here we go. Divisiacus. And in the commentaries, by the way, it's spelled Divitiacus.
Ah.
Divisiacus, which is maybe easier to pronounce. Divisiacus, embracing Caesar, begins to implore him with many tears that he would not pass any very severe sentence upon his brother, saying that he knows that those charges are true and that nobody suffered more pain on that account than he himself did. For when he himself could effect a very great deal by his influence at home and in the rest of Gaul, and Dumnorix very little on account of his youth, the latter had become powerful through his means, which power and strength he used not only to the lessening of Divitiacus' popularity, but almost to his ruin. That he, however, was influenced both by fraternal affection and by public opinion. But if anything very severe from Siva should befall Dumnorix, no one would think that it had been done without his consent, Divitiacus's consent, since he himself held such a place in Caesar's friendship. From which circumstance it would arise that the affections of the whole of Gaul would be estranged from him. He's like, dude, if you punish him, people are going to think it was my fault and they're going to just kick my ass.
I'm screwed. Please don't do it.
As he was with tears begging these things of Caesar in many words, Caesar takes his right hand and, comforting him, begs him to make an end of entreating and ensures him that his regard for him is so great that he forgives both the injuries of the Republic and his private wrongs at his desire and prayers. He summons Dumnorix to him. He brings in his brother. He points out what he censures in him. He lays before him what he of himself perceives and what the state complains of. He warns him for the future to avoid all grounds of suspicion. He says that he pardons the past for the sake of his brother Divitiacus. He sets spies over Dumnorix that he may be able to know what he does and with whom he communicates. So, again, we see Caesar as he is known, you know, we know in Rome, he's the kind of guy that forgives his enemies, tries to make peace, tries to do the practical diplomatic thing, tries to
get
favors. Okay, dude, I could punish you, but I won't. You owe me now, big time.
Yes,
So he, you know, he now has Divitiacus, even more on board. And he's let Dummy off with a warning, but he's not so naive that he trusts Dummy.
Yeah.
He has spies following him.
Right.
But he says, I want my grain and I want it quick, bloody smart, son.
That's right. Chop, chop.
Chop, chop.
Yeah. So I thought it was interesting. So roughly about that same time. So, and again, I just think that's very Caesar-esque. I mean, as opposed to trying to work something out or maybe, you know, kind of be subtle. Caesar literally brings him in. He goes, I know what you're doing. You'd better stop. I'm going to forgive you for this time because of your brother, his pleas. You mess with me again and I will fuck you
he
up.
He said, Fredo, you're my brother.
That's right.
And I love you. But don't ever take sides against the Corleone family. Ever.
Because that would lead to a fracar. And you don't want that with Caesar. You don't want a fracar with Caesar, okay? You do not want that. So anyways, so about that same time, the Helvetii are about 8 Roman miles away. And Caesar sends out his scouts. And he's like, well, I've got to do something because this is just untenable. And there's a patch of high ground next to where the Helvetii's at. And almost pretty much like what Marius did when he was fighting the Germans, he's got a plan to send some troops to that high ground, to sneak up there on the high ground. He's going to send his two of his veteran legions under Titus Labienus to the high ground, and then he'll march in with his men and basically engage the Helvetii, and then the two legions led by Titus Labienus will pour down from the hill, launch into their sides or to their backs, and just wipe out the Helvetii. And that's his plan. It's a pretty good plan. It's a pretty good solid plan, and that's what his decision is as far as dealing with these people and his dwindling food supply.
So the plan is that Labienus is going to take a hill on one side, and then Caesar picks a guy called Considius. He gave it a lot of consideration and picked Considius. Yes. He said, I consider Considius to be the guy. So Considius is supposed to be the scout. Well, he's leading up the scouts. They're supposed to go and say, okay, Labienus is in position. Then Caesar was going to take the rest of the legions up to the other hill. And then Labienus had been given instructions, when you see me attack, then you attack. Right? So wait for the signal. You remember the signal, Gary?
That's right.
So Considius...
Two-prong attack, yep.
Considius goes... So Labienus goes, gets into position. Caesar sends Considius out. Considius comes back, just about as Caesar's about to climb the hill, and says, The Gauls have taken the hill. We can't go. And Caesar's like, oh my God, either Labienus screwed up, he's been defeated, he got lost, he Took
could a pee be break. Dead right now. Yeah. Pee break. Yeah. Long pee break.
So it all goes to hell. Now, eventually Caesar gets out there late in the day and sees that actually Labienus was in position and he's been sitting around all day waiting for Caesar. Can't do anything, A, because he was given instructions, don't, you know, wait, you remember the signal, Gary? But also, you know, he didn't have a big enough force to take, I mean, they didn't have a big enough force combined, you know, to take on 100,000 guys. So, you know, with his one or two legions, he didn't stand a chance. So Considius screwed up. Now, interestingly, in the commentary, Caesar doesn't say what happened, how he, whether or not he punished Considius. He leaves it up to his imagination. But all he does say is kind of what he does say is kind of gold. I'm not going to bring it up and read it, but he says something like when he talks about Considius, he says like Considius, who was apparently I'd heard. Reliable.
Good
guy. I sent him out there to do it, and he screwed up. And that's all he says.
Yeah. Screwed it up.
So, of course, when these things were sent back to Rome as a report, everyone went, Considius.
You dumbass.
So, assuming he did survive, he would have been shamed for being a dumbass, as you say. Or just being, you know, I think the suggestion is that he was scared or something. Yeah. Didn't want to attack, thought it was too dangerous. They were outnumbered. Was trying to prevent it from going on, hoping that Caesar would change his mind or that the Helvetii would, you know, get a chance to escape before the attack and so he wouldn't have to fight. That we don't really know. But anyway.
All right.
So
let me ask this real quick. We've been at this for just over an hour.
Yeah, let's keep going.
You want to keep going? Okay. So basically Caesar is out of food. He's been begging the Edgewise for food. He's out of food. His big plan didn't work because of the dumbass. And so he has to turn around and start going back to closer to his base of supplies to get some food. The Helvetii take this and they interpret it as in he's afraid. So the Helvetii turn around and they attack the retreating Romans.
Yeah.
And that was not my closing voice.
Oh, good. Yeah, suck it up, people. We're going long today. We're going in.
We're going in deep.
Ray could get bitten by a snake, and I don't want to
keep going.
You know, we don't want, you want to know how this finishes, right?
Yeah.
So, so the Helvetii, dumbasses that they were, not dumb Norics, but just dumbasses, go, shit, yeah, we'll go get the Romans. Let's get the Romans.
That's right. Kill we did Romans. It before. We can do it again.
So this leads to the Battle of Bibracte. Which I have in my notes here where that is. Bibracte is near Burgundy, near modern Autun in Burgundy, France. You ever been to Burgundy, Ray?
No, I have not.
I have. Very, very lovely part of the world, just like to say. Very, very nice. So I'd like to go back there. If anyone listening is from Burgundy and you want to invite me over to stay in your villa, just shoot me an email. No, not you. You're gonna be
I have
dead.
An axe.
So Caesar's like, well, all right, bring it on, bitches. So he gets his 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th legions.
Mm-hmm.
And he leaves the 11th and the 12th. He's got six
the
legions,
new guys.
Right? Leaves, yeah, yep. The new guys, he leaves them behind. He says, look, you look after the bags, basically. Because the soldiers, the legionnaires have to carry all this shit with them. You know, they're traveling, right? So they've got a spare set of undies and a toothbrush.
Right.
And, you know, supplies, food. They normally carry them with their pack hanging over their spear or the staff that's on their shoulder, right? So they have to put their bags down. And he leaves a couple of legions to look after the bags. But also they're the extra reserve. They're extra reserve. So the way the Romans fought in those days, Ray, was you didn't send your entire force down. You had a reserve, and you even had a reserve for a reserve. But also what he would do is he would keep the reserve on the hill, standing there watching. So whenever the Helvetii looked up, they're like, oh, God. Like, once we get through with these guys, there's more guys. There's another 10,000 guys up there.
That's brilliant.
Like, it just looked like, man, there's just Romans everywhere. Just, you know, to kind of psych them out, right? Fuck!
Absolutely.
So, so anyway, Caesar's like, all right, bitches, bring it on.
Yep.
Now, there's some, you know, great stuff here about in the commentaries about the attack, but I'll let you talk for a bit.
All right. Well, I just thought it was neat. So he lines up his four veteran troops. He's got the two inexperienced ones back, and he's got cavalry and light infantry on either side of the two inexperienced troops. He's got his baggage. They've got their baggage. And the Romans have, think of it as, even though it's four legions, each legion is like in three lines. You got two lines, and then you got a third line. And the third line behind is almost like your first reserve that you would go to. So everybody's got to get their men in place. This takes hours. The battle doesn't even start until like halfway through the day or something like that. So the Helvetii keep coming closer and closer, and they're chanting and they're singing their songs and they're beating on their shields and they're trying to scare these Romans. And this is one of the things that I admire about the Roman armies. They just kind of stand there almost with a little, I don't know if you want to call it a frown or whatever. They just sit there in total silence and just watch these guys scream and yell and chant and whatever. And they're just very dismissive of the Helvetii, and they just stand there. And suddenly when the Helvetii get close enough, they launch their pila. And as you know, because it's very long, it's going to penetrate some shields. It's going to stab some guys. It's going to pin some shields together. And they're hard to get out. So they literally wait till they get close enough. They launch their pila. And then they just charge right at them, screaming and yelling. This is the only time they're going to scream and yell is when they're first attacking. And they just tear right into the Helvetii in a very organized, disciplined way. They're not just swinging wildly. They know that their arms and their strength is finite. And that they just go at it, and they turn it into a science, and they just start cutting down the Helvetii.
Yeah.
Is that a good start?
That was good. I was going to read actually what Caesar wrote about this just quickly.
Yeah.
You missed out a key part there.
I don't think so.
Yeah. No, go ahead. lucky I've got your back.
Thank you.
Before the battle started, Caesar sent his horse and everyone else's horses away. So he was like, "Well, I'm here, kids. I'm with you. We're going to do this together. We're going to go down together, or we're going to win together. Your Caesar stands with you." Probably right before here. He did that, he would have marched up and down the legions and given a little speech about, "I am Caesar. Hear me roar."
That's right.
These bitches, they think they can take us on. We are the mighty Roman army. But then he got rid of his own horse, and now this is the only time in Caesar's campaigns where he did this, where he felt it was necessary to put himself at the front of the troops, so to speak. I mean, he probably wasn't at the front of the troops during the actual fighting, but he was there with his men. Now, that was because at this time, we have to remember, he didn't really have a military reputation. This is his first big battle. Yeah. He'd done some minor stuff before. He'd been involved in other people's battles. He'd taken on the pirates. But this is really the first time that Caesar's the man in charge of the troops, and he needs to make a name for himself. He needs to win the respect of the troops. So he sends his horse away. And then, as he says himself in the commentaries, "Caesar, having removed out of sight first his own horse, then those of all, that he might make the danger of all equal and do away with the hope of flight, after encouraging his men, joined battle. His soldiers, hurling their javelins from the higher ground, easily broke the enemy's phalanx. That being dispersed, they made a charge on them with drawn swords. It was a great hindrance to the Gauls in fighting that when several of their bucklers had been by one stroke of the Roman javelins pierced through and pinned fast together," a buckler was like a little shield, a little round shield, "pinned fast together, as the point of the iron had bent itself, they could neither pluck it out nor with their left hand entangled fight with sufficient ease, so that many, after having long tossed their arm about, chose rather to cast away the buckler from their hand and to fight with their person unprotected." So the Romans throw the pilas, throw the javelins. The Helvetii hold up their shield. The javelin goes through the shield. The tip of the spear bends, and so they can't get it out. But then they've got this bloody big stick hanging out of their shields.
Right.
And so they can't move. So they throw their shields away. And, of course, then the Romans come in with the swords and go, "Welcome to Rome, bitches," and cut them to pieces. So, this strategy in the javelins first and then the swords second, the javelins would take down some guys, obviously, but it was to basically disable their shields and then they could go in hacking and slaying.
Yeah, I thought it was great. And what I was interesting is that, okay, so the plan's going well. They're hacking into the Helvetii, and suddenly this on the Romans' right, the Helvetii left, a large force of other tribesmen show up. I don't think it was planned. I think they just showed up late, or it was whatever. But so suddenly Caesar's got this big force on the right, you know, extended out further than his right. So what he does is he has the four legions peel back their third line that we talked about, and they shift over to the right to defeat, to engage them and keep them from being able to get into the Romans' rear or get to the Roman baggage. So again, it was something that wasn't planned by the Helvetii, but it almost worked anyway. But because Caesar never lost control, never lost poise, he's able to move troops around and still win the day, what could have been a horrible Roman massacre.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of the Battle of Waterloo. Those who haven't listened to the Napoleon show, the Battle of Waterloo, Napoleon took on the British under Wellington and defeated them, despite what Brits will try and tell you. And then at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, when his army is kind of tired and spent, the Prussians turn up under Blücher. Even though Napoleon had sent some guys to say, look, just keep Blücher away so I can finish off this snotty-nosed Brit, and then we'll take care of Blücher tomorrow. And he defeated the Brits, suck on it. And then, but his the guy that he sent to keep Blücher at bay screwed up, and Blücher turned up at the last minute. Now, in that case, Napoleon obviously lost. But in this case, Caesar was able to pull it together because he'd kept a reserve. Napoleon's reserve had already been used at that stage. In this case, Caesar had, and the Gauls had turned up. There were 15,000 of them, like the equivalent of three new legions turn up.
Right.
Which, like, it's non-trivial, particularly when Caesar only started with six legions and two of them were inexperienced, brand new. But, you know, this is a testament. And this is where Caesar made his bones, girls and boys. Out of this, you know, it wasn't like a clear-cut, massive victory. He lost a lot of guys.
Yeah, too many, yeah.
Apparently he spent, you know, the next 3 days. Like, the Helvetii managed to escape. Some of them got away. But, and Caesar didn't chase them. He spent the next 3 days basically tending the wounded and burying the dead. So, you know, he took a beating. But he won against massive numbers.
Yeah, not only did he stand with his troops, you know, he sent his horse to the back, but even after the battle, he's going to spend time tending to the wounded. So he's showing his troops that he is loyal to them, which will in turn make them loyal to him. And when he does start gathering a lot of money, gold and whatnot, and he pays them far more than what they really have a right to deserve, again, these troops are going to be even more loyal to this one individual who will know how to use them.
Is that your closing voice?
It doesn't have to be.
No, good, because there's more stuff here, man. Are you in a hurry? I know you got stuff to do. So one of the things that I think it's important to cover here is Caesar says that 130,000 Helvetii escaped. He managed to take a bunch of prisoners, including a son and daughter of Orgy or Getarix. Right. But, okay, so do the math here, and this is something he doesn't go into. 130,000 people escaped. How many did they start with?
Yeah, between 300,000 and 400,000.
Yeah, about 368,000 according to his Nats. So 130,000 escaped. That means we've got 230,000 dead. Now, his own numbers say that about a quarter of their original tally, 90,000, were men, warriors. Mm-hmm. So 230,000 dead. That means, you know, at least 150,000. Women and children slaughtered by the Romans during this exercise. Like, you know, there were, they probably already lost some in the early skirmishes, but, and, you know, they lost a bunch, the Tigurini, when they were trying to cross the Song. But any way you slice it, there are 100,000 or more women and children slaughtered by the Romans in this battle. Right. Now, Caesar doesn't talk about that in the commentaries. But, you know, you think about that for a second. I mean, this isn't a battle just men against men, soldiers against soldiers. This is a battle that involves the deaths of, you know, civilians. And let's think about this. I mean, okay, yes, the Helvetii were marching, and but okay, for Americans in particular, think about it like the Pilgrims. You know, these are people, like, think about the women and the children and the elderly in the village who are told by their chieftains, look, we're going to move and you're coming with us. And we're going to walk to the promised land where there'll be milk and honey and it's all going to be good. And you know, they can't say no. So, yeah, you know, they get forced to go on this journey. Their leaders piss off Caesar. And as a consequence, they get slaughtered, women and children and probably some elderly, slaughtered on the fields of Burgundy. You know, it's brutal stuff. This is a brutal, this is a brutal thing. I mean, it's easy to get lost in the military mano a mano stuff, but I want to think about the consequences to the civilians who got caught up in this. They, you know, it wasn't their fault. They didn't ask for this. They just wanted to live their lives as people all around the world have always wanted to do. Most people just want to, you know, raise their kids and have food in their belly and live a
peace,
live a good life. That's right. They just got slaughtered as a result. But, you know, Caesar made a name for himself.
Yeah. And if I can add to your point and to everyone's misery, the for lack of better term, the slave traders, the slavers knew, had enough experience to follow Roman armies around. So even for those Helvetii that may have been captured and they're not dead, there's a good chance they're going to be sold into slavery because that's the fastest way for Caesar to raise money. And so even if you're not dead, your family might be dead, but suddenly you're going to be someone's slave and taken to probably a far-off land for the rest of your life. Yeah. So that's the other reality.
So after 3 days of burying his dead, Caesar goes after them. But they were headed towards the territory of the Lingones, the Lingon. And Caesar sends messages out to the Lingon saying, listen, don't give these people any food, don't give them any shelter. If you do, you'll be my enemy, and we're going to come after you. So the ones that do escape, the 130,000 that get away, have nowhere to go. Then Caesar comes after them, and they send a delegation to him and say, look, we want peace. We're sorry. We want peace. Yeah. So Caesar says, okay, I want some hostages, and I want to disarm the warriors. And then that night, about 6,000 men from one of the clans, you know, go on the run. They're like, oh, my God, this isn't going to end well. So they take off. Caesar has them captured, brought back, sells them into slavery, as you was indicating, for, you know, he'd done a peace deal. They'd run away. So, sorry, you don't get the peace deal now. Now you get sold into slavery because you pissed me off.
Right.
But then what does he do with the rest of them?
Actually, I'm going to let you handle that.
Okay, so with the rest of them, he says, I know you've come all this way. I know you've lost 2/3 of your people, but you're going home. And he sends them back to whence they came.
Wow.
Back to Switzerland and says, you're going to go back. You're going to start again. You're going to rebuild your villages. Don't ever come this way again. We want you where we want you. You're going to stay where you are. I don't care that you don't like it. I don't care that the Germans are next door. I don't care that it's cold and it's mountainous and any of that stuff. Look, it's Switzerland. Go build cuckoo clocks.
Yeah, right.
And from that day on, the Swiss have never given anyone any trouble ever because Caesar just brutally wiped out 2/3 of their population. According to Caesar's own commentaries, the 368,000 people left, you know, started the journey. Mm-hmm. Only 110,000 returned home. There were 32,000 Boii people, one of the tribes or cantons, minus their casualties, who were allowed to settle in Gaul. 6,000 were sold into slavery. So there was 220,000 people, give or take, that died as a result of the battle against Caesar. Like, I don't know, man. It's a horror, right? I mean, you know, sure, you know, in the 20th century, we saw a lot more people die from ill-advised wars, like the one that you cover in your World War II podcast, and the one that we're just celebrating the 100th anniversary of World War One and Vietnam, and even recent invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan and stuff that's going on today. But still, let's just focus on this time. And this was a lot. I mean, again, this is 58 BCE. 220,000 people. Like, these Helvetii had been around God knows how many centuries, thousands of years, little tribes building, growing, you know, slowly building a civilization for themselves. Imagine how long it takes to grow, you know, a people of 368,000 that's wiped out, two-thirds of which is wiped out in a matter of days. A day. Yeah. A day. Majority of them are wiped out in a single day in a battle.
I mean, what we know about how many children died in childbirth and stuff like that, I'm sure it took them a very long time to build up to that number. And like you said, in one day to have, you know, hundreds if not thousands of years worth of work or progress, you could say, wiped out. There's two points I want to make, and then you can close up. One, I don't remember the numbers, but remember when we were talking about Pompey had finally come back from the east, all the number of battles he had, the number of people he had killed, the number of he had captured, it was like a decent percentage of the world population. Well, here in one day, Caesar is well on his way to catching up to Pompey's numbers. And the other thing, when I read about the Helvetii surviving, the ones who did survive, walking back home, all I can think of as an American who has studied American history, how we treated the Native Americans here, all I can think of, well, that sounds to me like the original Trail of Tears.
Yeah, the only spot of light in all of this is perhaps the fact that these numbers are overinflated. Modern scholars tend to think the numbers that of Helvetii that they started with probably aren't that big, but either way,
it was still a massacre. Yes, absolutely.
All right, well, that's it. And before we go, we have to do the reviews and give away some coffee mugs and t-shirts, and we have to talk about the toga competition. So a few more minutes, ladies and gentlemen, bear with us. If you don't care, if you don't care about the reviews, like our friend Jay Leslar from the United States, then you feel free to turn off now.
Jay.
But you won't find out if you want a coffee mug.
That's right.
If you don't listen. So here's the reviews, from some great reviews this week. I want to thank everybody in advance. I'm going to run through them really quickly. Luby McD from the United Kingdom. Nice to have a British listener. Life of Caesar and earphones have enhanced both favorite and hated pastimes, cycling and housework, and made both so much more enjoyable. What's not to love? Cameron is as witty as hell, and Ray's little giggle always makes me smile.
It is cute, isn't it?
You got a little giggle.
I do.
Both remind me of that rare university lecturer type who can bring an already fascinating subject to life, making it interesting and fun, hard to stop listening to, grateful for long cycle rides, and a house that needs a lot of cleaning. Bloody marvelous, guys. Well, this will be a good cycle ride. We're going to go an hour and a half today.
That's right.
Thank you. 5 stars from Libby McD. CN_Domitius_Severus from Australia. Amateur history gold, 5 stars. I'm already subscribed to Ray Harris's massive and excellent World War II podcast. As a bit of a failed history student, I'm a keen fan of the History of Rome and the History of Byzantium podcast. So be warned, this is not like those podcasts.
Mm-mm.
American Ray Harris plays a straight bat mostly to the abrasive, hilariously opinionated Aussie Cameron Riley.
Huge asshole.
This podcast is a more in-depth look at Julius Caesar that would build on the information from the History of Rome podcast or from Common Knowledge. It is history as entertainment, drawing out the juicy bits that makes you want to know more. For me, the laughs outweigh the pronunciation that is like acid in my ears, or that the focus is occasionally wayward. The enthusiasm for the subject that gushes from Ray and Cam is what drives this podcast and takes you along on the adventure. I have listened to the first 7 episodes this week. No wonder his ears are filled with acid.
Yeah.
You got to take it in dosage. He also explains Americans need to know that Cameron lives in Queensland and they tend to disdain the rest of the world, much like Americans do. Australians view America as a rich, eccentric uncle. We love you, but your direction makes us worry a bit. Not helped by the Australian love of I told you so. And he goes on and talks about some books. But thank you, Demetria Severus. Somebody from Australia, Booba Feta, history made interesting, 4 stars, though prone to drifting. And then I forget what I was saying. No, this is nonetheless fascinating and fun show. An American actually said, great show, 5 stars. This is one of my favorite podcasts. When a new episode shows up in my feed, sorry, he's called All American Man, shows up in my feed, I give a little fist pump and a silent yes.
Damn.
I don't get the negativity about the show. If you want an entertaining podcast that proves history doesn't have to be dry facts, this is your show. I love the casual conversation and interaction between the hosts. It's like they're sitting at a bar with a drink in one hand, a cigar in the other, not continents away. They're funny and engaging. This would be the perfect show to introduce young people to Julius Caesar. I only gave it 5 stars because I couldn't give it 10. Five for each host. And then he says, sorry, Ray, you need to take a page from this podcast and not be so stiff and forced when doing your History of World War II podcast.
Hey, buddy, I'm incredibly stiff and forced, so I know what I'm... I got this. I got this, okay?
Ray is incredibly stiff. That's going on the next coffee mug.
People like it stiff. I'm
Jay
sorry.
Leisure even gave us 3 stars but slabbed us. Can you beat Pulisula from Catalan RL in Spain? A review from Spain. Thank you, Catalan. I like their other work separately on Napoleon and World War II, but this is a great clash. The two and recounting the life of Caesar. Really fun, but chock full of factual stuff. And then Firstborn 18 from United States. 5 stars. Great show. I love the show. It's entertaining while informative, and the two blend together nicely. I've seen some of the negative reviews, and they seem to be written by people who want to put their blinders on to the rest of the world and incorrectly chant, USA is number one at everything, which isn't patriotic. It's naive, and the problem with the US today. But enough about the ones who can't take anyone pointing out that US isn't the only country in the world without a vein in their forehead popping out. Keep up the great work, guys. And Insane But Brilliant, 5 stars, by Coops, 1969, from United Kingdom. History by Inspired Maniacs. Get this in your life. You won't regret it. So who do you want to award the coffee mug to, Ray?
Damn. Well, if it wasn't so expensive to send out, I'd send it to everybody. How about the house cleaner, bicyclist? Who was that? Was that CN? Who was that?
That was Luby McD from United Kingdom.
Luby.
I think Luby's a lady too. Because of the housework, but I think I saw her say something on Facebook or Twitter.
Okay,
Luby McD, if you email Ray at...
lifeofcaesarpodcast@gmail.com.
With your address. And tell him if you want a t-shirt. Is a t-shirt an option, Ray?
Unfortunately, because of prices, there are 3 different mugs to choose from. You can see them on the Facebook page of Life of Caesar Podcast.
And a fourth one now says Ray is stiff. Yeah.
You can't have too much stiff. Anyway, please email me.
And also, if anyone from iTunes is listening, I think we should send one to the iTunes podcast people, James or James's team. By the way, James Boggs, who, as I said before, runs this, he was in Brisbane a few years ago, and he and I had a stogie together, man. I took him out and I bought him a Cuban, and we... got a good photo of that. Yes, a cigar. Good guy, James. Thank you for the support, James and iTunes team. Now, toga competition, just to wrap up. Ray and I talked about this after the show last week. If so, we've got a new competition. Send us a photo of you in a toga. We're going to put it up on the website. The best toga photo that we get not only wins a prize, but you have the opportunity. You will also have the opportunity to come on the show.
Yes.
We will Skype you in. You can chat with us about Caesar. Tell us how awesome we are. correct our pronunciations, Steve Murray. So, best toga photo, email it to CameronRiley@gmail.com and I will make a decision. And then come on the show. That'd be fun. All right,
you get to experience Cameron's hilarity and my stiffness, and we're just gonna have a great time with it.
Thank you, everybody, for listening, and thank you for the reviews and the comments. We love yous all. And thank you, Ray, and good luck with the snakes.
Thank you. Go USA! Sorry, I had to die. So. We probably lost.